Oh, okay.
I saw, but I didn't know the answer.
Eric, thank you.
This come, you know, tomorrow.
All right. Today is April 4th, 2017. This is Joint Committee on Ways and Means, Subcommittee on Human Services. Today is a continuation of the public hearing on Senate Bill 5526, the Department of Human Services, the Child Welfare Division. And we have Director Psyche and Director Lena Al-Husseini. If you guys want to come up. It looks like we're continuing with slide 14.
So, good morning, Chair Rayfield and Chair Steiner Hayward. For the record, Clyde Psyche, Department of Human Services. We're back for day two, and we have quite a bit of ground to cover, so I'm going to turn it over to Director Al-Husseini. But before I do, just one quick note. We were able to get responses to a couple of the questions that were asked yesterday. Got the information to Ms. Byerly this morning, and she got them posted on OLIS. So they're for your review.
Thank you.
Thank you.
And I'm going to turn it over to Director Al-Husseini.
Thank you and good morning. For the, Chair Steiner Hayward, Chair Rayfield, members of the committee, for the record, my name is Lena Al-Husseini, Director of Child Welfare. And we are going to start with slide 14 with well-being. And as you can see, we have 1,359 youth received independent living program services provided by 9 contracted community-based providers. The foster care independent living program serves current and former foster youth from age 14 to age 21. The services that we provide include life skills, money management, budgeting, communication, social skills, community connections and supportive relationships, informed decision-making, parenting, health, education, support, wraparound services. I mean, I don't want to go through the whole list of this. One of the big focus on this is to develop transitional plans to ensure that the youth complete high school and successfully make the transition from school to post-secondary education or employment at a level that allows them to be self-sufficient. This includes also housing support options, should they choose to use them, and excuse me, and enhance attention to comprehensive, culturally appropriate transition planning for youth as they transition to living independent. As they transition.
Senator Steiner Hayward.
It's okay.
I'm sorry. I didn't even see you.
Trust me, really, I wanted you to be able to finish your sentences.
Sorry.
I want to hear about this. I'm going to ask about this program. So if you want to finish your comments about this program, that's totally fine.
I am so sorry. I didn't
no.
talk. Okay.
Go ahead. Good Lord, I'm feeling guilty now. Could you talk a little bit about the data that you have on how, because certainly not all foster youth aging out of the program go through this, right? And second of all, do we have data on how well kids going through the different contracted programs do? Do we know if some of them are more successful in helping kids have the skills that they need, those life skills that they need when they get out? Do you have data on those kinds of things? Because I think one of the concerns we've had lately is fidelity to evidence-based models of programming. And I would imagine that with 19 different providers, it can be tough to ensure fidelity to a model. And I wonder what kinds of tracking you're doing.
Chair Steiner Hayward, Chair Grayfield, members of the committee, may I ask Laurie?
Please.
To come, my deputy.
Please.
Good morning, Chair Steiner Hayward, Chair Rayfield, members of the committee. For the record, my name is Lori Price. I'm Deputy Director of Child Welfare Programs. Senator Steiner Hayward, yes, in fact, we do have that data. Our contracts with these 19 providers are outcome-based contracts, and we monitor them both for the number of services and quality of services provided to our youth. You're absolutely correct. We cannot serve every youth in the program. We're financially limited, but we do prioritize youth based on their age and based on their likelihood of aging out of the foster care system.
All right, Mr. Chair.
Please.
Thank you. Thank you, Ms. Price. So I guess my next question is, do we have any way of tracking young Oregonians who've been through the program and have been aged out of foster care to determine whether they are more successful in certain ways after going through this program, you know, a year, 2 years, 3 years down the road compared to children who don't? Because frankly, if it's a question of money and if we have data that show that they're less likely to be dependent on other state services if they have in fact been through these programs, then that's a good investment of our money, right? And we, but to be confident about that, we need data about long-term outcomes.
Sure. Chair Steiner Hayward, Chair Rayfield, members of the committee, there is a national report required called NITED. It's the National Youth Transition Database, where there are a cohort of youth age 17 that are tracked as they progress in age. The issue with that is keeping track of youth sometimes, but the state is actually measured on how well we track those youth that are members of this cohort. So we do have that data. It's part of a national data set, and Oregon does feed into that national data set. So we could look at that and tell you based on these sections of children and watch them age through the system.
One more, Mr. Chair.
Please.
Thank you. So if this committee were to request that you work with Ms. Fredland in the self-sufficiency department and figure out how many of those young people 3 years after completing the program are getting SNAP benefits or are on TANF or on other programs, would that be, and I'm partly asking you and I'm partly asking Mr. Psyche, yeah, since this is in your agency as a whole, how hard or easy would that be to do? I mean, you, those are Social Security numbers, right? You wouldn't even have to find the young people. You could just cross-match Social Security numbers, right?
So, Chair Steiner Hayward, Chair Rayfield, yeah, we could go back and talk to Ms. Fredland, and there are ways, I think, that we could probably do some matching. The one thing I would submit to you is that sometimes it's not necessarily a bad thing that the person is receiving benefits for a limited period of time. For instance, if we have a foster youth who is going through either community college or a four-year college, working towards employment,
sure,
having them be on SNAP benefits for a 2 to 4 year period of time is not necessarily a bad thing. Again, it's supporting them as they're working towards a long-term goal of independence.
Point well taken, Mr. Psyche, and I probably misstated what I was really trying to say, and thank you for clarifying that point. I guess my real question is, are we getting the bang for our buck?
Yeah.
I understand that you're required by federal law to track. I understand that it's difficult to track, but I also understand that there are ways of figuring out what,
yeah,
people are doing and ensure, you know, if we can figure out ways to invest more money in this program, if we have data that show that it really does help kids be more successful down the road, then that's a smart investment on our part that ultimately saves the state money,
right,
by helping them succeed.
So Chair Steiner here, Chair Rayfield, point well taken, and we will go back and sit down with Ms. Fredland and see kind of how we can maybe do some data matching and track some of that.
Thank you, Mr. Sager.
Senator Winters and then Senator Gelzer.
Thank you. Since we're on tracking, how long are the foster youth tracked after they've aged out? One question, because there's also the interest, in addition to talking about what other state services they may be using, but there's an anecdotal, there's some of us who have this thing of, and Director Psyche know that I've been working with the Department of Corrections, trying to, where, you know, we see where some of our youth who have been in foster care have ended up in OYA or going on in that trajectory into DOC. So my question is, what's the length of tracking that you have so that we can begin connecting those dots?
Good question.
Chair Steiner Hayward, Chair Rayfield, members of the committee, Senator Winters, I know that they are tracked through age 19, but I do not specifically, 17 through 19, but I'll need to go back and get that specific information for you on what we do beyond age 19. For the NITED report, I know it's ages 17 through 19, but let me go back and take a look.
Well, additionally, Director Psyche, that might be something in the data sharing program that we've been talking and working with OYA, that we capture that through that portal.
Absolutely.
Thank you.
Senator Gelzer.
Thank you, Chair Rayfield.
So we're really lucky in our office to get to hear directly from a lot of foster youth, and many of them talk about ILP being really the best part of their experience in child welfare and one of the only places where they feel like someone is focused just on them and their long-term goals. But they also talk about difficulty getting referred from their caseworkers to ILP. So can you talk a little bit about how kids can get better connected early on? And then the second question, kind of building on to Senator Winters, what type of support are foster youth getting when they age out of the system? So, for instance, if they age out and we track them until 19 and they become parents at age 20 or 21, what kind of a network of support, parent education, are we putting around these youth to help them be successful as parents rather than setting them up for a new generation of kids in foster care?
Chair Steiner Hayward, Chair Rayfield, members of the committee. Senator Gelser, thank you for your question. I am struggling a bit with the answer, and I want to be sure that I'm giving you accurate information. What I can tell you is for kids that age out, some of the things that we can do is tuition assistance, housing assistance, some of the other wraparound services. But to answer your specific question about parenting, I'll have to go back to Rosemary Iavendetti, our program manager over our independent living program services, and get specifics. I would hope, and I'll go back and talk to Rosemary about connecting them with our nurse home visiting program through public health and through other agencies, but I don't know that child welfare specifically provides parenting services for youth as they age out and become young parents.
And then the referral piece to ILP for...
Oh, for the workers, pardon me. Co-chairs, Senator Gelser. The referral piece, it does happen through the caseworkers. That's an ongoing education piece for us, but it's also a limited resource for folks. So we can serve, you know, roughly 1,500 kids a year through our independent living program services, through the Chafee grant and other funding sources. That doesn't by any stretch capture every youth ages 14 through 21 in our system.
Thank you.
Next, we're going to talk a little bit about the homeless and runaway youth app downloads in 2016. As you can tell, there's an estimated 13,238 homeless people in Oregon, and around 9,354 have downloaded the app. So certainly, there's a need for this. It gives them all sorts of information, like where's the nearest shelter, where they can get information, where they can connect with people, where they can get services. But just to frame it a little bit more, currently, in terms of the homeless and runaway youth, we have 25 contracts with 14 providers. Our funding is at $2.8 million. And just to put it in comparison, Washington State spends around $20 million a year. while homelessness across the nation continues to decline, and I think we spoke a little bit about this yesterday, Oregon has the highest percentage of homeless families with children not living in a shelter, according to the latest national estimate by the U.S. Department of Housing and Urban Development. The 2016 annual homeless assessment report estimates that 59.1% of Oregon's homeless families with children spent the night on the street or in a car, park, or another public or private place that is not normally seen as sleeping accommodations. And while the number of people, as I mentioned yesterday, of people experiencing homelessness as part of the family with children decreased in 41 states from 2015 to 2016, Oregon has a 2.5% increase, the fifth highest in the nation. And I think the report was posted on OLIS, so you can all take a look at the numbers of the report that I mentioned yesterday.
Please, Senator Gelser.
Thank you. I just wanted to go back to ILP because my staff just sent me a question. She used to work in ILP. Is it true that housing and college tuition services are only offered if you're in the program? And if for some reason you're removed from the program or you stop participating, you no longer access those, are no longer able to access the housing and college assistance programs?
Chair Rayfield. Chair Steiner Hayward, members of the committee. Senator Gelser, that's absolutely true. And that's part of why there's a bill that is up before this legislative group that talks about changing the requirements for children to remain eligible for the housing and tuition assistance. Yes.
Thank you. And one more follow-up.
Please.
I think one of the reasons that concerns me is we've had a series of youth kind of coming through the office in ILP who've been frustrated because they'll be asked to do things like attend a certain school or move, and they're told if they don't do what they're told by that caseworker, they'll be removed from the program. And they feel pressured by that because of the access to services. Is there a way to kind of protect that for youth if they're trying to make decisions as a 19-year-old about themselves, but the consequence of disagreeing with the decision is they lose their housing and college assistance?
Chair Refield, Chair Snyder Hayward, members of the committee, and Senator Gelser. I would have to know specifics about that case. There are laws and laws legislated by this legislature and rules that require that the child participate or young adult participate in so many activities to remain eligible. It's part of what we're asking to loosen up so that we have more flexibility. At this time, the department does not have a lot of flexibility in that. But on a case-by-case basis, we'd be happy to address concerns.
Okay, and we can continue sending those. Would it be normal practice, though, for a caseworker to say, do this or else? I mean, is that...
Chair Gelser, Chair Gelser, wrong committee. Chair Rayfield, Senator Gelser. If it is a requirement by law, it could very well be. So it would depend, again, if there's criteria that they meet a certain number of hours of participation, which right now is the law, and they're not doing that, they've got a grace period, and then, in fact, they would lose their benefits. So we would have to, again, look at the case specifics, and hopefully we'll see some relief for that with a bill that's before the legislature this session.
Thank you. That's very helpful.
Thank you. If there's no more questions, I'll continue.
Yeah, please.
And we spoke yesterday at length about our health and wellness program. I think the only thing I didn't mention yesterday was we have 16 nurses positioned across the state. If you have any questions, please let me know. So we are going to go to permanency in our child welfare services. And with permanency, we provide the subsidized adoption and guardianship placements for children who cannot be safely returned to their parents. With the Title IV-E waiver, it allows us to test activities that fall outside of those allowed by federal regulation for federal funding. So the Oregon's current version of the waiver, called LIFE, Leveraging Intensive Family Engagement, attempts to achieve reunification earlier in cases where all indicators point to a child remaining in care for 3 years or more. And this is where I think Representative Bueller, you mentioned, where we're thinking about innovative program. This allows us to test out new programming. Okay, sorry.
Yes,
I thought
absolutely.
You were correcting me.
No,
This allows us to test new programs. So currently, we're testing programs where we're doing much more intensive wraparound services with kids who are considered, are at risk for being long stayers, and we provide wraparound services to their families so they can support them and help them, both for the children and for the families. But there's a whole host of programs, and I can send you more information on that as well. In terms of the post-adoption services, that includes our subsidy payments, medical coverage.
Senator Winters.
I just have a brief question. When you talked about when permanency or termination of parental rights began, the idea or the program was to make certain that that you did in fact do intensive wraparound services to the families, and if that proved not to be to work out, then you would then begin the process of termination of parental rights so that children could get stability. Is that what you're? Is that the kind of thing that you're talking about?
This is for children who have been reunified with their families, and correct me if I'm wrong, the program I mentioned, right? The Title IV-E waiver.
Right. Chair Rayfield, members of the committee, Senator Winters. The LIFE program is a Title IV-E waiver, which allows us to use the federal Title IV-E funding, which is the primary source for funding child welfare services, in a flexible manner. So typically, for instance, Title IV-E can't be used for preventive-type services. But what we use this particular body of money for is to provide a lot of family engagement and specifically family meetings, to try to find additional resources We look for additional resources for children. We bring their families together, extended families, people known to the families to provide services. But all of these children are not yet reunified with their family. But it's in an effort to build a community around that family to increase the likelihood of the child being able to return home safely to have those additional supports.
So to stop, Chair Rayfield, members of the committee, Senator Wentz.
Question. So what is the length of time that this engagement takes place? 1 year, 2 years, six? What on average is the length of time of stabilizing the family? And
Chair Rayfield, members of the committee, I believe the term for the LIFE program is 18 months. The term for the waiver is 5 years.
Okay, it's the same. Thank you.
Okay.
Different terminology, but same concept. Thank you.
Okay. And these are for the children identified as potential long stayers as well, so there's the difference. In terms of post-adoption services, it includes our subsidy payments, medical coverage for children who have been adopted or achieved guardianship through our agency. In addition, our permanency unit contracts for post-adoption services through Oregon Post-Adoption Resource Center, among others as well. And then the Interstate Compact assures home studies are completed and courtesy supervision occurs for children placed out of state or those entering the state of Oregon from another state, child welfare program. And in terms of federal policy planning and resources, our federal policy planning and resources are basically responsible for maximizing federal funding for our agency by assuring accurate eligibility determinations occur, and all our federal state plan requirements are met, and federal reporting is accurate and timely. If there's no more questions, we can go to the next.
I'm going to follow up just on the adoption piece. Thank you, Mrs. Chair. What's the length of time? Do you have a length of time that it takes when you begin the process of that a child will be eligible for adoption? Do you have those? I'm sure you do have those statistics.
Mm-hmm. Chair Rayfield, members of the committee, Senator Winters, there are national standards that we meet.
I don't want national standards. I want what we're doing.
I'll get you that data.
Thank you.
Please, Senator Gelder.
Thank you. And how many children do we have today legally free and waiting for adoption?
Chair Rayfield, Senator Gelser, I don't have that number off the top of my head, but we absolutely have it as a department, and we can get that for you. Okay,
thank you. And a follow-up?
Please.
I think another way to ask Senator Winter's question, you know, a lot of times we see on adoptive family websites the picture that says 900 days in foster care and now I'm adopted. If we could know the average number of days a child waits before they are adopted into permanency, that would be great, too.
Please. Chair Rayfield, Senator Gelser, we can get you that information. We're going to go to permanency. 58% of the children leaving foster care were reunited with their families. 748 children had adoptions finalized. This is all from 2016. And 90% of the children adopted also had siblings adopted by the same family as one or more siblings. To me, this is really good. 3,321, 82% of the sibling groups in care were placed with the same family as one or more siblings.
Mr. Chair.
Please, Senator Gelser.
Thank you. On the first one, among the 58% that are reunited with families at foster care, do we know within a three-year period after that how many of them return to foster care?
We can get to you. Chair Rayfield, Senator Gelser, we can get you that data.
Thank you. That would be helpful. Okay. And maybe a list of the number of times kids reenter, kind of go through the door of reunited back to foster care, reunited back to
Definitely.
Foster care.
Thank you. Can do that. Permanency. This is, we're going to talk a little bit more about LIFE. There's 600 case planning in terms of the Leveraging Intensive Family Engagement LIFE program, which is the title, the waiver program we talked about earlier. 600 case planning meetings through LIFE with 127 parents working with parent mentors. This is the program we discussed earlier. 282 children exited foster care to guardianship. And some of the things we do, like the four key features of this program, it's a values-based intervention focused on reducing the time to permanency for children likely to remain in foster care for 3.5 years, as I mentioned, the long stayers. Some of the key features include the family finding, which is identify and engage a broad network of family support and placement resources, case planning meetings, which is case planning and monitoring informed by child and family voice. Peer parent mentors help parents engage in CPMs, which is the case planning meetings and services, navigate the child welfare service systems, and collaborative team planning between service providers involved with the case. Out of these, am I right? Yes. So far, if there's no more questions, I'm going to speak a little bit more about the Oregon placements, the interstate compact for placement of children, which is an agreement among states to coordinate the transfer and placement of children across state line. It's a uniform legislation. All 50 states are members, as well as the District of Columbia and Virgin Islands, and the provisions are the same in all member states. ISPC was adopted into law by the 1975 Oregon legislature. For 2016, we've had incoming requests, 450 cases. We've had public agency requests outgoing, 690. And we've had placements incoming, 101. And we've had placements outgoing, 142. In terms of private adoptions incoming, we've had 25, and in terms of private adoptions outgoing, we've had 52. In 2016, we've also had 1,688 total contacts through post-adoption services. So once children are placed in a permanent family, the program continues providing support to the families to meet the special needs and lifelong challenges of children who have been abused and neglected. DHS provides a comprehensive array of services and operations that include consultation and direction to the process of legally freeing children for adoption, recruitment of potential adoptive and guardianship families, and selection of adoptive family resources to support services that help ensure the post-legal success and longevity of adoption and guardianship placements.
Please, Senator Winters.
Can you provide us, you said there's ongoing support.
Yes.
Two questions. One, the length of time on that ongoing support, and the budget for that ongoing support.
Chair Rayfield, Senator Winters will do that.
Thank you.
So the service delivery structure just shows you the comprehensive range of services that we have at DHS, and we work very much together as, definitely with self-sufficiency for me. It's almost like prevention work for my cases, but we work with the tribes, with developmental disability, which we have a large number of, with healthcare, housing, community providers, educational system, our judicial system as well. So it's really trying to get all sorts of services coordinated to address the needs of our children.
Okay.
Moving in the right direction. So the some of the things that we're doing at child welfare that I think is moving in the right direction. We have, and you probably heard a little bit about our new worker training redesign, where we have, if you have questions on that, we have AJ, who sort of oversaw all of that. We also have implemented the foster parent support line, 211, and we have apps for runaway youth and foster parents, which I mentioned earlier. In terms of the numbers, from August 2016 to January 2017, the foster parent support line has received 107 calls, 33 emails, and 3 texts for a total of 143 contacts. A majority of those contacting the support line are foster parents who were given the support line information by their DHS certifier. Most of these calls came from Multnomah and Marion counties, and statewide, the outreach work still continues.
So is it a different 211 than the 211 I might call if I have a question about how to get my power put together, and has there been special training for the people that are answering the phone calls?
Oh, sorry. Do you want to come back up? This is Chair Rayfield, Senator Gelser. This is a support line for foster parents. I'm not sure if it's different, so Lori can talk a little bit about that, but I know there's been training.
Chair Rayfield, Senator Gelser. Yes, it is the same 211. There has been training, specialized training. The foster parent support line runs from the after hours only. The access to the app, which directs foster parents to resources, which directs homeless and runaway youth to resources, those apps, that's available 24/7.
And follow up?
Please.
So if I'm a foster parent and I call at 2 in the morning and I'm in Union County, mm-hmm. and I'm having a crisis, will I talk to somebody live that can help me right then and right there and actually come to my house or meet me and provide support?
Chair Rayfield, members of the committee, Senator Gelser, yes, you will talk to somebody live. No. Probably not in that county will you have somebody there immediately, but it depends on the crisis situation that you've got. They would engage the local child welfare if it was an urgent situation, but you'll have a live-to-live person to speak with, yes.
Okay. And one more follow-up. Multnomah County and Marion County have a pretty robust 211 system, but in a lot of other parts of the state, it's not that robust in terms of the local community resources. So if somebody calls 211 in Benton County and gets referred to a resource in Portland, that's not really accessible to them. What has that been an issue, and how will this work for foster parents that don't live in the urban areas?
Chair Rayfield, Senator Gelser, it has not risen to my attention. I'll follow up with Kevin George, our foster care and youth transition manager, when I get back and see if we've only had positive feedback that I'm aware of access to the support for foster parents after hours.
Representative Bueller.
Yeah, just a point of clarification. So the app is only available through the 211 system, is that correct?
Chair Rayfield, Rep. Bueller. Yes, that is correct. It is a 211 helped formulate the app. We contracted with them to develop the app. They support the app, and they keep it up to date with current resources for families and on the Homeless Runaway Youth app for services for homeless or runaway youth. Yes, you can download it from anywhere. Was that your question? I'm sorry.
Let me clarify. So if I am a foster youth in a county in Oregon which does not have 211, can they still access and use the app?
Yes. Chair Rayfield, Representative Bueller, absolutely yes.
Okay. So it's not dependent on their geographic location.
No. Okay. I guess I do have a follow-up.
Okay. Please, Senator Gelser.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Is the 211, and I only ask this question because I know when we've tried to help constituents in our community, sometimes if it's built by people that aren't in the community, uh-huh. the phone number will go to a place that maybe was there a year or two ago, but it isn't there anymore. So if this youth in a community that doesn't have 211 downloads the app, is the app populated with, do we know that the resources are current and available to the youth and that there aren't kind of disconnected phone numbers or organizations that have gone out of business?
Chair Rayfield, Senator Gelser, that's certainly our intention. That's what we've contracted with 211 Info for. That's our expectation, yes, is that whatever is available on the app is active and available to those accessing the services via the app.
Chair Rayfield, Senator Gelser, I downloaded it, yes. What I downloaded, it showed me what's around me, what's available. So in my case, yes.
Yes. Can we go back to new worker training to redesign?
Yes, I was going
to
go back there.
And my question is, and I think that's great to talk about new worker training redesign, but what about existing workers and the supervisors?
Chair Rayfield, Senator Winters, there's a lot of work that went into that, and it's an ongoing training, and I have AJ here who spent a lot of time working on the redesign of the training. I'm just going to talk a little bit before she sits down, but it really has been really well thought out. It incorporates trauma-informed lens. It uses things like simulation on the job training. It takes over a year for new. You want further already?
I want further because training for new ones coming in is great.
Right.
However, If you're not training throughout the system, particularly those who have a supervisory responsibility, that the oversight, and I just needed to know what's all included in your training redesign, because it's my hope that we're getting at some of the issues, and Director Psyche and I have talked about this. Mm-hmm. It doesn't do us any good if things become inconsistent.
Chair Rayfield, Senator Winters, I agree with you. And may I ask AJ to give you some more information? She spent a lot of work on it.
Thank you. Representative Rayfield, members of the committee, Senator Winters, thank you for your question. I'll try not to take too much time because I get really excited about this.
she gets me excited.
As part of... Oh, thank you. For the record, my name is Anna Jim Goins, and I work for Child Welfare. As part of new worker training redesign, we're building in training for all supervisory staff and building in supervisory supports. So there's ongoing tools and resources for coaching and supervising and supporting really new workers through their first year, but it's a tool that could be used with any worker. Next step, which we're embarking on in July, is doing the same kind of comprehensive review and assessment of our ongoing worker training so that we can further refine that and get beyond training in the moment to have a consistent and organized over time ongoing professional development pathway for workers and supervisors.
Great. Follow-up.
Please.
Is this being conducted through, is contracting out, or are you doing some of this in-house?
Yes. Oh, Representative Rayfield, members of the committee, Senator Winters, thank you for your question. The answer to that is both. We have a significant contractual intergovernmental agreement with Portland State University that does the majority of our training. Through Portland State, we also have some subcontractors that do have particular types of expertise. And we also do in-house training with our consultants and our own, the expertise we have within our staff.
So Chair Rayfield and Senator Winters, you and I have had a lot of discussion about that. And one of the things that concerned me when I came on, because one of the questions I asked is, I know we put people through core training, but then what's our formalized process to bring them back after their first year, their second year, and their third year to make sure that we're giving them additional training or support early in their careers? Because, you know, my experience has been a lot of times you can sit through a training that does or does not prepare you when you actually get on the job and start to experience things firsthand. So that's something I spoke with AJ about, and I think she's doing a really good job in making sure that we have kind of an ongoing process so that with new workers, we're bringing them back, you know, at specified times early in their career to make sure that we're hitting the mark. And I also have talked to her about, once we implement, tracking what impact that has on our retention rate, because I just intuitively or feel that because we're not providing that support, it's playing into our ability to retain staff. But I want to track that to make sure that it's having the desired outcome and effect.
Thank you. As you know, this follow-up,
please.
You know, this has been one of the issues that I have consistently talked about, and I just have to also say on this side of the aisle, I don't think that we've done as far as the investment that we should have either. So just putting that on the record as well.
I couldn't agree with you more, Senator.
And what type of follow-up do you guys have after someone completes core training when you talk to the frontline workers that have actually been through your training?
Representative Rayfield, members of the committee, we have several evaluation tools that we've built into our training. We do a knowledge assessment. We do a worker summary that Portland State University provides to the supervisor. We've done surveys of both new workers and supervisors who have gone through our current core training. We will continue to do that. What we're building into the new worker training redesign is simulation and we will record that simulation, and both the new worker and the supervisor will get feedback on that as well.
But after someone comes out of core training and they're back in the field 2 months down the road, one of the things that I've done is I've gone around the state and met mm-hmm. with a lot of frontline workers, right? And so they do not feel supported when they come out of core. They don't feel, quite frankly, the training's adequate. And they're being left into a situation where they have a lot of important decisions to make, and they don't feel like they have the resources and are being supported within their different needs. And that's a common theme around the state, right?
Yeah.
And so what are you guys doing to remedy that?
Right. Thank you, Representative Rayfield, members of the committee. That's really part of the intent of the redesign, because we discovered that, too, when we did our analysis of what's working and what's not working. The building the supervisory supports is one huge key to that, so that supervisors have a way and have tools to provide that ongoing support for a new worker who may be struggling or just maybe having a hard time with the very difficult work that we do. The other thing that we are building into the training is either having a supervisor assign a lead worker to be a mentor, if you will. And the work that we do with Portland State University and our consultants to do follow-up with a new worker in the field to provide side-by-side support on a periodic basis through that first year.
So how does the lead worker, when they've got a full caseload, have the time mm-hmm. to be a mentor?
Well, yes, that's a very – Representative Rayfield, members of the committee – that's always the challenge of the staff that we have with the resources we have. What we've built in our new worker training redesign is as many types of support as we can build in with the resources that we have. Mm-hmm. And so we'll continue to monitor that as the new worker training redesign becomes a reality.
Yeah, trying to do the best with what you got. So, yeah. Senator Winters.
Thank you. Have you done an analysis of how much is being contracted out to Portland State versus how much actually you might want to retain for in-house? And I say that because I'm just following up on the question that was asked by Co-Chair Rayfield of if you have both the lead worker or other workers who need the coaching or some activity right away, can't wait till somebody from outside get to them, how do you handle that? You know, at one time you did have a robust in-house training mm-hmm. capacity. Mm-hmm. And so, you know, I've struggled with this of how much has been outsourced versus how much maybe you need to retain in-house.
Representative Rayfield, Senator Steiner Hayward, Senator Winters, members of the committee, that's an excellent question. I don't know that we have done a fiscal analysis of that. I do know that in our work doing analysis of training for our staff, we're tracking the training that is provided in-house and the training that's provided through the university. So those numbers we report annually in our federal report, and we can provide that kind of information to you.
Can you go back and then look at the individuals that your turnover is very high?
Yes.
Can you go back and look mm-hmm. at that particular issue and say how many of those had we had the support in-house versus what's happening outside? Because there's something that's taking place.
Right.
That is creating and attributing to both the turnover rate that is taking place and some of the activity that have happened within cases. So, you know, for me, it's kind of like doing an analysis of saying what are we doing on the front end, and then what are we doing in the overlay of providing support and training to our workers to make certain that they're getting the tools that they need timely.
So, Chair Rayfield and Chair Steiner Hayward, Senator Winters. So I think you've hit the nail right on the head, and it's something that's really kind of been bothering me and something we've been kind of trying to work to address. So several things. In discussions with Stacey Ayers, who's the manager of our Child Protective Service agencies, first of all, Stacey, it's something about names. You know, when you get older, it just... Yeah. I'll call you Tracy from now on. You know, he has consultants, safety consultants, who are in every district in the central office. And we were just discussing the other day, is there an expanded role those consultants can play out in the field as far as doing case reviews and consultations with staff, case managers? And I quite frankly, I think that kind of on-the-ground, real-life training is just probably as valuable as anything we can do, because it's in time, in real life. The other thing we're doing is that at one point in time in the field, we had a position called a CET position. And going around the field, I also heard a lot about that. So what we've done is we're doing a pilot in District 10, which is over in Deschutes County, where we've actually allowed them to bring two CETs on board, and we're going to track what impact that has on retention rate. And if it has a positive impact, I think we're going to look at expanding that, because, you know, the role of the CET, they do things like the first time a worker goes out on a home visit, they will go with the worker, which to me, I don't think we should be sending people out for the first time by themselves. But that's kind of the role the CET could play, and so we're piloting that again. I mean, it's kind of like Back to the Future. And then the final piece is we have to deal with the caseload that our supervised frontline supervisors are carrying, and we have to increase the skills and ability of our frontline supervisors. Those are really our first line of defense and are the best resource to make sure that the people are getting the training and the support that they need. So I think, you know, it's not a kind of one-size-fits-all. We're going to have to approach this in 4, 5, 6, 7 different mm-hmm. ways in order to have the positive impact.
And Director, I heard some of the same things. Like folks that have been there 20, 25 years talk nostalgically about their training and the way it was vastly different, or it was more of a year-long process and some of these things. So I think that makes a lot of sense. Representative Bueller.
Yeah, thank you, Mr. Chair. Seeing that Mr. Ayres is here and I reviewed some of the answers to the questions, I'd like to ask him some questions if we have some time during the session when you think it's appropriate.
Yeah, and just I think from a time management standpoint, I've asked a lot of questions. I think we've all asked a lot of questions. We still have 20 more slides to go and about 25 minutes. So maybe if we hold them to the end, is that work for you?
We can get some time.
Yeah, so then move through the slides, and then maybe we can resume kind of a flurry of questions at the end.
Thank you. So. In terms of community partnerships, an example would be Embrace. Every child, I don't know, I think the committee members are familiar with Embrace Every Child, and basically it's a statewide initiative that connects caring Oregonians with opportunities to support vulnerable children and families. And we've been working with them since 2012. Just some of the numbers I'm speeding it up, but some of the numbers, 3,500 volunteers are involved, 750 tangible needs met for children in care, 12,000 welcome boxes made for children entering care. And for me, this is a really beautiful thing. They do a little box with a welcome note for little children. It's really wonderful. It says here 13 makeovers. I know it's 14 makeovers as of today, because one of my district managers called me to thank me and tell me what a wonderful job they've done. They've done 14 makeovers, beautification projects at DHS offices, and totaling more than 300,000 in donations. And they have we've had more than 550 foster family inquiries since 2015, which is a really very impressive number in my opinion. We spoke a little bit about the health and wellness program yesterday, so unless there's additional questions. In terms of the licensing and safety review team, we meet monthly to discuss licensing and reviews. This basically ensures that all agencies in DHS are working together, and you know, all the overlap, we're managing all the overlap getting information to everyone, and we spoke already about the 4E waiver. Centralized screening. So we had a committee that looked into the idea of centralized screening, and it was almost unanimous. I think one person, but it was almost unanimous. They have recommended centralized screening, and there are many reasons, all of them listed for you here. But it obviously ensures, number one, it's child safety, it's 24/7, more efficient services, more effective services. And the one thing we're going to be doing is the areas that we're going to pay attention to is the accountability part, and providing the training specific to screening, like a screening academy, quality assurance, adequate staffing, that's huge, and consultant support, and of course 24/7 in the districts. One of the things we've also done is looked at ways we can manage that staffing in a smarter way, using analytics and staffing analytics to really sort of forecast what the needs would be. If there's no more questions, I can go to the next slide. Community engagement and partnerships, family support centers. Some of the ideas we're thinking, as I mentioned now, currently we have families that are basically early intervention centers. Where they can work with collaborate with our workers, but provide support in every community. One of the, as you all know, I came from a settlement house model, and what I think would be wonderful to have in Oregon is working with organizations in every area that understand that community's needs, that understand the cultural needs, but provide services basically from the cradle to the grave to support our work at DHS. So basically, you walk in, you find your health services, your self-sufficiency, parenting skills, basic health care, education training, all of that. So these are some of the ideas we're working with our partners in the community. We want to build stronger relationships with our child caring agencies. I've already mentioned yesterday, we've been asking them to come up with ideas and tell us their capacity and give us suggestions how we can work better together. We've received some very interesting ideas, and I can sort of report on those once we finalize that whole process. But it's been eye-opening for me how innovative and how committed they have been, our community organizations. Public-private partnerships is trying to, you know, very similar to the Embrace model, which is maybe working with our philanthropic community, working with other partners to stretch our resources, for instance, to sort of coordinate where we spend money to have a strategy going forward. So some of the ideas we're talking about here at DHS, and of course, differential response, which will support all of that. Our staff challenges. And when my staff saw this, they're like, you should put something positive. So I'm going to say the positive. The staff are amazing and really committed. We have very committed, dedicated staff, very professional, but they have a lot to deal with. And these are some of the challenges they deal with. And I wanted to highlight this because a lot of our staff, it's very negative all around them in the media and all of that. And I wanted to highlight how hard they all work in spite of all these things. They're overworked, the overwhelmed. Most of our caseworkers don't have the 14 allotted cases. Many of them are working 20 and above even, which I'll tell you, in my experience in New York, you know, my staff wouldn't accept it from me, in New York at least. So I have to give credit to the staff at DHS. They really go above and beyond. They're overwhelmed and they're under-resourced. So I think I'm stating the obvious, but I wanted to state it and give them credit for all the work that they have been doing. And the reality of our staff, you know, more of the same, the life and death decisions that they have to make every single day, trauma, you know, that the children and families are dealing with, demanding caseloads, traumatic stress for them as well, personal stress, lack of resources, and the insufficient time. Turnover in Oregon, 23%. The cost for each worker leaving the agency is $54,000. A third of our workforce always is new because 31% of our child welfare SS1 caseworkers have been in the position for less than 18 months. Some areas, our turnover rate ranges from 23% in some districts to 75% in other districts. And yes, nationally, child welfare, the turnover nationally is 6 times the national average, but it is quite high and it does take a toll on our work.
Mr. Chair?
Please.
Ms. Al-Husseini, clearly you're going to have some troubles with recruitment and retention. Mm-hmm. It becomes a vicious cycle at some level. If you have inadequate staff and you have you lack the capacity to provide adequate training and support to new staffers, then the chances of them feeling less than competent and having adequate job satisfaction and avoiding burnout are not great, right? It's not surprising that you have trouble with retention. And you've talked a little bit about some of the things you're talking about doing to improve that. Do you feel like the criteria, the qualifications that you require for to apply even for the positions are the right ones? Do you have a sense of how you might rethink some of that, if you think that's appropriate, to potentially recruit other people who might be more likely to tolerate some of the challenges to help build up your workforce?
Chair Steiner Hayward, Chair Rayfield, members of the committee, that is a really great question. And we have been discussing this, both myself and Director Saki. Some of the recommendations I have given to our HR is to look into maybe caseworkers, not to only ask for a bachelor's degree as a requirement, but also look into life experience as a possible substitute. So therefore, we have more diversity in our workforce. You get maybe older people with more experience who have chosen to come into this field. And, you know, there's so much nuance in our work. When you enter a home to understand the complexity of the work, it experience counts. So that's one way of looking at it. Another thing that I think Director Saki had mentioned earlier, we're looking at our supervisors and how we can sort of help and support them, whether it's looking at their level and looking at their all the things that we provide for them. And I'm hoping at some point to start asking or helping them get more MSWs. I'd like more clinical oversight from the MSW, from the supervisor level. That's one of the things we've been looking into. Did you want to say something?
So, Chair Steiner here, we're Chair Rayfield. I think training is a critical piece of it, but it's not, for me, just kind of the in the classroom, for lack of a better term, mm-hmm. training. I feel very strongly that unless we can solve the problem of how we support people once they get on the job on a day-to-day mm-hmm, basis, mm-hmm. we're not going to break this vicious cycle.
Sure.
And so really, you know, whether it's through consultants who can help staff cases and do that on-the-job training, we definitely have to increase the skill level of our frontline supervisors. And concepts like the CET concept, I think unless we address how we're supporting people once they get on the job on a daily basis, we are going to be stuck in this cycle for some time to come. Mm-hmm. And one of the things I've asked Mr. Ayers to do, and he and his staff are working on it, I've asked him to put together kind of just a brainstorming group or a think group that includes district managers, program managers, frontline supervisors, and caseworkers in child welfare. And I really kind of want to spend some quality time with them and some dedicated time in talking about, so what is it that you need? Tell mm-hmm. me what would help you and your staff be successful. And we've done that from time to time, but I think for me, there's a window of opportunity here. And my job is to really clearly identify to you that in the short term, here's what we need to start to turn this around. And in the long term, here's what we need. And so that's the work we're going to do. And several of you have asked me to come and talk to you about that. So I will be coming to talk to you about that. And it's really about not just long term, but what can we do today? And what kind of investment do we need to make today to start to turn this around and break the cycle, because we are stuck in a very vicious cycle right now.
Thank you.
And I want to add two things: vicarious trauma and compassion fatigue. I don't think we have anything currently in place for our staff. I'm going to start working with the Casey Foundation, trying to integrate that in our practice as well, because we recognize that it really does affect how our staff feel every day when they come to work.
Next.
Next, which is House Bill So the House Bill 2345 and Senate Bill 525, which is the high quality legal representation for Oregon's children. This is really important for us, and we're hoping if this is passed that the legal representation will be provided through DOJ. And the bill provides for a phase-in, especially in larger counties, because our staff are child welfare workers, and we've talked already about their challenges and lack of resources. Forcing them into a court to act, you know, as their own attorney to represent themselves is really stressful, and it doesn't help them or the children that we are helping and supporting. As Judge Brewer said, it's very likely Oregon is the only state in the nation that does not provide legal representation for its caseworkers. Child and Family Services Review, and if I may ask AJ to come back up again. So the Child and Family Services Review is basically the report that we present to the Children's Bureau, which ensures conformity with our federal child welfare requirements, determines what is actually happening to children and families as they are engaged in child welfare services, and assists states in enhancing their capacity to help children and families achieve positive outcomes. The reviews are structured to help states identify strengths and areas needing improvement within their agencies and their programs. And as you can see, this is where we started in March 2016, and currently in May 2017, we're working on our program improvement plan, which we are going to be submitting in May. This happens every 6 years. Oregon was reviewed in 2001. That was round one. 2008, round two, and began round three in 2016. And each review measures the state's ability to achieve 7 systematic factors and 7 child welfare outcomes, which are the statewide information system, service array, case review system, staff training, quality assurance system, agency responsiveness to the community, foster and adoptive parent licensing, recruitment, and retention. The final the results found the state in substantial conformity with 2 of the 7 systematic factors, statewide information systems, and agency responsiveness to the community. This result was no surprise to us and reflective of Oregon's self-assessment published in 2016.
Yeah,
if you have any questions, because I have AJ here who can answer anything. The Child Safety and Substitute Care Independent Review, and this is, I'm sure you're very aware of it. The Governor and Director Psyche solicited an independent review of DHS Substitute Care System to determine what improvements are needed in order to ensure child and youth safety. The review revealed critical gaps in child safety system, not just in child welfare, but across the whole department, child welfare, background check unit, licensing, Office of Adult Abuse Prevention and Investigations. And the Unified Child and Safety Implementation Plan describes the action that the agency will take over in the next 2 years in response to the independent review. Oh, sorry, I jumped.
That's okay.
Well, the previous slide, which I jumped, basically was self-explanatory, but it was telling us the more appropriate placements could prevent abuse of children in substitute care. Placement have to be... they recommended earlier intervention. There was a whole host, and we can send you that review that was published, and it's on our website, actually. One of the things that Director Psyche thought was very important was there needs to be a single point of contact for all child safety related improvement work. I'm sorry, would you like to speak about this? Or am I? Okay, because I'm speaking on your behalf.
You can go ahead.
Okay. Nathan Ricks is the new executive projects director, and his team is using project management over the course of the next 2 years to make the changes we have needed for a long time. The goals of the plan are build trust between DHS families, providers, and youth receiving DHS services, ensure child and youth needs are considered when delivering services, especially substitute care placements decision, ensure swift safe and comprehensive response to reports of child abuse, cultivate a youth-centered, safety-first culture at DHS, retain, train, develop, and recruit certified families and licensed child agency providers. So if you have no more, and it's all posted on our website, and we can send you the link as well. I believe during Director Saki's Ways and Means, these questions came up, which is how does Oregon child welfare rank? And in looking at all the data, you know, every state ranked really well in some things and did really badly in other things. So there's no uniform, like best in practice state per se. We wanted how we rank, for instance. So I'm going to go first of how Oregon child welfare ranks and then talk about child welfare nationally. In terms of our key indicators, in care, the national rate is 5.4%. We're at 8.9%. In terms of, which is the, and it's self-explanatory, it has it. Kinship care, the average is 30%. We're at 32%. Permanency, the standard is 40.5%. We're at 40%. And recurrence of maltreatment in 12 months, the standard is 9.1, we're at 11%. So we have work to do, obviously. Child welfare nationally, the lowest in care rate, and it tells you where we are. So we're not doing that well in the lowest in care. We're number 42 of the 50 states. Number one is Virginia, Maryland, Utah. And best safety performance, Alabama, New Hampshire, Wyoming, we're number 27.
And Director Hosseini, if we could, what I think we want to do is get Mr. Harris up here, and so if we could actually maybe skip over the priorities and then let's go through, and this is just based
budget
on,
budget overview is also explanatory, unless you have questions.
Well, let's go through the budget, and then maybe what we'll do is stop short on the key performance measures, and then bring him up. Okay. I think that's just kind of the collective will of the committee at this point.
So let me, I'll walk us through the budget. So again, you're familiar with this pie chart. Child welfare is $1.05 billion, or about 10% of the total DHS budget. Here's a breakdown of child welfare by program. Then you can see where the money goes. And then, again, a familiar chart to you, it's really the breakdown, and you can see that 46% federal fund, 52% general fund, and then 2% of other funds. And then, again, another familiar chart to you, but it just shows when you talk about money, where the money goes. One of the things about this that looks a little bit different from some of the other charts is that the staffing costs are captured under the delivery, and so this is the direct care child welfare staff that works with clients on a daily basis.
Our key performance measures, and I think these were already agreed upon in the last session, the absence of repeat maltreatment, timely reunification, timeliness of adoption, legally free, disparity in foster youth achieving permanency within 2 years by race and ethnicity, and children served by child welfare residing in parental home.
Okay, I think we'll bring Mr. Harris up now.
Yeah, Chair this. Yeah.
Thank you. Okay, so you're good with these.
Okay. Well, we can always come back and look at them in a fun KPM session if need be. But I think what we'll do at this point.
Your definition of fine and mine are a little different.
Can you tell me when that's scheduled so I can be out of time?
Absolutely. So Representative Bueller, I think, had some first questions.
Mm-hmm.
And then Senator Gelzer.
Thank you, Chair Rigdon. Mr. Harris and others who provide the answers, I thought they were very informative to our questions yesterday. But just a few points of clarification. Mr. Harris, probably you're most appropriate to answer this. Do you feel confident that the DR assessments are adequately taking care of the concerns of children in the system?
Chair Rayfield and Representative Bueller, thank you for the question. I'm just going to get on the record. My name is Stacey Ayers. I manage the Child Protective Services Program for the department. Thank you for the question. It is it's a tricky one. I appreciate you asking it. I am concerned I think there's been enough information that's been provided so far. I think there were some reports that came out fairly recently about some of the assessments that are done primarily in alternative response cases that we've looked at so far, where there have been some pretty concerning practices and not really addressing safety of children. And I think that is my paramount concern. Does that answer your question?
Let me just drill down a little bit.
Okay.
So are there services provided to kids in the alternative track that cannot or are not provided on the traditional track?
Services can be provided in either track. So the same services that are provided in alternative response can be provided in traditional response.
And is that the standard practice? Or I know they can be, but are they?
I think that there are definitely some differing opinions about whether that's happening. In my experience and the reviews that we've looked at, I think there are some concerns about whether or not services are provided. I think the reviews that we've done are indicating that cases are being closed out too quickly when children are not safe. And so services are not being offered, and we're walking away from a situation where we should be involved.
Please. And I'm sure you're well aware of the attention that's been given on the internal DHS report. That's just a small segment of many kids. Do you think that was a representative sample of the children that we are caring for in the state of Oregon, or was it just a more anecdotal type of look at what's going on?
Well, again, Chair Rayfield and Representative Bueller, I thank you for the question. We were pretty thoughtful. If you're referring to the specific review that was done, there were 101 cases that were actually looked at. We were pretty intentional about trying to gather what could be considered a representative sample of cases so we could actually draw some conclusions from that. And so, yeah, I do feel like it was, it's not an anecdotal pool. So,
Chair Steiner here, Chair Rayfield, and Representative Bueller, as we discussed yesterday, we all have concerns about the information that Mr. Ayers provided. And I think yesterday, that's why when I spoke about this to the committee, number one, one of our priorities is to go back into counties where we have already implemented differential response and really kind of work with the consultants and staff to find out in practice how we implemented this and make sure that we are working with staff so that we are moving into a place where that the right decisions are being made. And number two, and I talked to Director Al Husseini about this, is we're not going to implement this in any new counties until we are certain that, number one, we've resolved a lot of the practice issues or many of the practice issues, and number two, that the counties we feel are in a place where they can implement the system properly. And so, this was a very concerning report, and I will tell you that I have asked Mr. Staff and actually got a report last week to go back on all 45 of the cases and report back to me on what the status of those children were and families, and just explain to me what we did to follow up and to ensure me that we have eyes on the kids and the kids are safe.
And just, Chair Steiner Hurwitz, Chair Rayfield, just to add, I've asked Stacy to take a look at all of the state and do a similar comparison across the state so we can really look at all our practice and get a really good idea of where our weaknesses are and what we should be working on and what we should be, really focusing on.
Yeah, and I think we've got a couple of questions, but really quickly, two of them. First one is, in each county, judges have a different temperament on how the subjectivity of how they're going to implement the law and how they view the law. How does that translate to the CPS workers in various counties, and how and the sensitivity of, you know, what meets a certain threshold? So I'm curious about that subjectivity. The other side of it is, and kind of reading the report there, you mentioned that 10 to 15% that are in the alternative response eventually switch to traditional response. And my understanding is that if somebody has moved into an alternative response, that's voluntary. And if they had the safety to remove, they just didn't have that criteria in the moment to meet the threshold at a judicial review. So those 10 to 15%, my understanding is without the DR review, they would have had to have come in from some other outside outside source. But because the DH was actually involved in those families through DR, we actually kind of actually, there was an improved safety for those children under those at least 10 to 15%. Is that an accurate, and I'm trying to read between the lines and trying to understand what was reported in this, but I just want to see if I'm understanding that properly.
So Chair Rayfield, if the question is to me, it's and members of the committee, that is a, there's a lot in there to kind of unpackage.
Yeah, two things, yeah.
Well, maybe even more.
Yeah.
And the question about judges and the judiciary and how that impacts decision making is a really good question, because it really it's something that we hear across the state. I mean, I travel around the state as you do, yeah. Many of the legislators on the committee do. And I'm keenly and acutely aware of the struggles that our field staff are facing with judiciary and with the temperament that you mentioned, some of the struggles that they have with getting cases through the system that need judicial intervention. So it is not something that is lost on us, and it does impact our ability to make decisions at times. The issue about alternative response and whether or not it's voluntary, technically, alternative response in and of itself is not a voluntary type of assessment. It is a track. It is a decision has been made by a hotline that a report meets a definition of child abuse or neglect, statutory definition. And then based on whether or not it's severe or not, it goes down one track or another. If it's a more severe allegation, it goes down traditional. Mm-hmm. If it's less severe, it goes down alternative. Still, the idea is that, and the training that is provided is that in alternative response, you're still doing an assessment. And if you find that a child is unsafe, you're still assessing, making that determination. I think there are some flaws.
I think you're misunderstanding my question. What I'm talking about is the families, once you've gone down the DR response, the families actually interaction at that point. Mm-hmm. If it is a non-removal situation, it's their voluntary compliance. There is no court saying, you know, yeah, we can force a family to comply with anything.
So I didn't misunderstand, Chair, but I think the distinction here is that if it really depends on whether or not a child is safe or not. So if you go down alternative response and you determine that the child is unsafe, it is not a voluntary situation anymore. Our intervention is required. It's mandated. We have no, we don't get to just say we can walk away. But if it's not, if the child is safe, and we have identified that the family is in need of services, high to moderate need cases, then at that point, it becomes voluntary whether they want to participate.
And that's the part that I'm talking about.
There you go.
Yeah. Yeah. And so, and that voluntary side, it mentions that there's about a 10 to 15% in the report. Is that the 10 to 15% in that voluntary track that eventually shifts over into the traditional track? And I'm
so
getting two different
it isn't.
Answers.
And so the issue about the cases switching from alternative to traditional, that is a situation where those cases were identified as being unsafe, and we couldn't work with that family on an in-home basis. And so they had to switch to a different track.
Okay, that's what my question
so
is.
Chair Rayfield,
that was my impression.
Yeah, you're correct.
Okay, thank you.
You're welcome.
Please, Senator Hayward.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. This is a two-part question. The first part should be pretty much binary. Mr. Harris, do you believe it's possible to do alternate response in a way that can protect our children's safety?
Chair Rayfield and Senator Steiner-Hayward, I think it's possible. I'm not seeing it happen.
Okay, wait. I wanted a binary answer to the first question. Then I was going to ask the second question to all three of you. Given your concerns and the concerns that all three of you, I think, share at some level, and I sort of asked this question yesterday, but I'm going to reframe it today. Do you have specific recommendations, in addition to the things that Mr. Saiki outlined, about statutory changes that we need to make or rule changes that you need to make that would increase the likelihood of having children who are put, families that are put in the alternate response track held as safe as possible? I mean, give it, you know, safe as possible as if we were doing everybody on a traditional response track.
It's not
talking. I'm happy to clarify. Okay. Unless you want to.
Chair Steiner-Hayward, Chair Rayfield, yes. Some of the things I think I mentioned a little bit yesterday. Currently we have the traditional response with DR. My experience in the past has been in some states you would have a middle way, for instance, where there are concerns, where there's families with serious concerns, but they are not unsafe, but we are concerned about them, where they're mandated to work with our community partners, where there's eyes on those children from day one. So when the case comes in, automatically, when it's alternative response, there's a community partner that comes in, and they are mandated to see them. In my case in New York, for instance, it was twice a month. We had to see them in their homes, and they had to visit, to check in with us, and we had to do case reports within a year. So that's one of the things, among many, we'll be discussing, and hopefully we'll bring recommendations to. But, you know, we can always look at the system in a way and see and try to make it even better. It doesn't mean there's problems in certain areas with it that it's not a good system.
Well, let's get one last question, and then I think we got to adjourn to get people to caucus. Senator Gelzer.
Certainly. I would like to hear Mr. Ayers' answer to that question. And specifically, given the resources that we have right now, so it's a two-part question. What do we need to do today to keep kids safe? And when you talked about that 47 being a representative sample, is it just about those 47 kids, or does that tell us that about 47% of our assessments out there, 47% of the assessments that are done today, we should be concerned are being identified as safe when they're not safe, so that every day, for every 100 kids that are getting assessed, we need to have somebody going back to look at them?
Right. So, Chair Rayfield and Senator Gelzer, thank you for the question. As far as rules and statutory changes and things like that, I don't know if you have something specific in mind about that, but
would entering dispositions help?
I think that. It will certainly have an impact on whether or not alternative response cases can happen, because I think that is one of the base kind of components of alternative response is no disposition. As far as the question about safety and being able to extrapolate from the review that was done, yes, I'm absolutely concerned about the number. It was a significant number. It wasn't, it wasn't 20, it wasn't 30, it was 101 cases. And anytime you have a situation where you pull that large of a sample and come up with the conclusions that we came up with, it should be that the response is startling.
If I may add also, Chair Steiner-Hayward, Chair Rayfield, members of the committee, also I want to put it in context. The review was done on DR cases only. We haven't looked across the state for us to give you a really realistic look across the state, right? We only looked at DR counties. So I think it behooves us to wait till we get the whole state and then really decide whether we should move forward or not.
So would that improve the number or worse?
So
So at this point, I have 5 minutes to get everybody to caucus that I have been ordered to get. We may schedule a follow-up meeting on this because clearly it's important to everyone. I appreciate you guys being here today and bearing with all the questions and rushing through all the slides. So with that, Ms. Barrow, do we have anything?
Tomorrow's public testimony on child welfare, self-sufficiency, and kind of catch-all programs.
All right. So with that, thank you again, everyone. We'll go ahead and adjourn for today.